Hi there, global citizens. Welcome back to the podcast that inspires a borderless mindset around manifesting a new world. I am your host, Florence Adu, coming to you from Accra, and we are at the start of Women's History Month. So I'm very, very, very excited to share another Her Story that vibrates so strong for me because we met through my sister, who's one of my great cheerleaders, and through her sister. And so we met in South Africa late last year and just had a really nice connection around the work that she's doing and her global citizenship. And so I wanted to invite her to have a conversation about all of those things. And we took a tour with her tour company. So that was also very inspiring and a great experience. And so I'll get right to her bio. She is the immediate post-director of the African Gender Institute at the University of Cape Town in South Africa. Prior to this, since 2000, she worked with civil society organizations and interacted with a wide range of social justice activists, peace builders, conflict resolution practitioners, diplomats, and peace and security personnel in over 11 countries in Africa. She is a skilled conflict resolution practitioner, trainer, and facilitator who has experience in assisting nonprofit organizations and government officials across the African continent, particularly during her time as senior trainer at the Center for Conflict Resolution based in Cape Town. Alongside this work, she has taught and written on African feminism, peace, security, and development at the University of Cape Town since 2008. She has a PhD in social development that investigated the micro-politics of women's peace activism in northern Uganda. She's also interested in post-conflict reconstruction processes, social change processes in times of crisis, and notions of respectable femininity, marriage, pleasure, and hetero, in parentheses, sexuality in Africa. She is a co-founder of Malia Tours and Transfers, which focuses on travelers seeking out sites and histories in South Africa that are distinct from those in other countries and is based on the experiences of the co-founders living in the Western Cape. Yaliwe Clark, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yes, I'm so excited. Yes, thank you. Thank you for joining us. And I'm excited for our conversation, particularly because after reading your bio, I think there's so much wonderful insights that we can gather. So let's get started with where are you from? Where are you local? And what is your craft?
So I was born in the United Kingdom. However, just for the month, my parents happened to be there studying. And so I was born there, but I am actually grew up in and know myself to be a Zambia located here on the African continent. So that's where I grew up. That's who I am. Yeah, that's where I'm from.
Okay. And where are you local?
I'm local in Cape Town, in the Western Cape, as you say, in South Africa. I moved here in 2006. I often refer to myself as a migrant worker because the push or the invitation to move here was working with the Center for Africa, a Center for Conflict Resolution that you referred to in my bio. I had just finished a master's in peace and conflict transformation. I had begun already to do some work in peace building, conflict prevention in Southern Africa. So I was very excited after my studies to be able to work for an organization that does the praxis of the theory that I had just completed.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
That's wonderful. And what would you say is your craft?
Many things, as you can tell from my bio. I think my first craft is broadly within the area of social justice, and it's about community change processes. Some of those community change processes would be within institutional framings like peace processes, negotiation processes that are quite structured, led, and publicly known by governments. But most of my work is probably, I think, more aligned with the kinds of social change processes that are not that well known, not necessarily named as social change processes. And so mine is a craft of grounded, conversational, that seek the possibility of change, right? And that is at the heart of also what it means to be a feminist, which is to be aware of that which in society needs to change, that oscillates around what it means to be gendered in this world. And gendering is part of being human, right? And so there's a lot in the world that has to do with the undermining, invisibilization, oppression, violent attack of people who are gendered a particular way. And often these are people gendered feminine, woman people, or people who are against the norms of gendering in society. So, you know, you're a man, but not in the normative expectation, the typically rewarded performance of masculinity, then you would be have a difficult time. So my craft is, I guess, understanding those social political dynamics in our immediate society, understanding them deeply in a way that enables the possibility of change. And the way in which I try to facilitate that change is through deep dialogue processes, whether that's teaching class, 17 years of teaching undergraduate and postgraduate at the University of Cape Town at the African Gender Institute, which has now a full undergraduate and postgraduate degree program, which we now call the Department of African Feminist Studies. You know, I taught there part of creating that trajectory. And I think teaching is a place of the possibility of shifting minds and enabling the kind of deep self-reflexive commitment to making a shift. So I do it through teaching. I also do it through my conflict resolution work, which through this began more explicitly at the Center for Conflict Resolution in 2006 when I moved here. But I continued through my time with the African Gender Institute as a teacher, continuing to be involved in feminist organizing processes on the ground here in the Western Cape, in my own country, and through the African Gender Institute's network, interacting with organizations continentally. And particularly now, I think the craft I'm offering in that area is dialogue processes that enable feminist organizations and movements to come. It's a very hard time we're in, you know, to come to agreement on what kind of strategy is needed now, right? And that craft, I think, became evident to me during COVID in 2020 when I was approached by a consortium of feminist NGOs who were having a hard time, 6 or 7 very large NGOs having a hard time just agreeing on how they would navigate their collective work at the height of the pandemic and then thereafter. So I assisted them in dialoguing, helping them dialogue with each other. So that's a craft, I guess. And it comes through teaching, it comes through feminist organizing, conflict resolution work that is not necessarily thought to be conflict resolution work, but it is about deep dialogue processes. And then through my tour company, I guess that's also about opening the possibility for Africans on the rest of the continent to meet Africans here in Cape Town, in a tourist industry that's still dominated by what we would call very easily here in Cape Town, white capital, which is people own the companies, the people who run the tour industries, the people who are serviced, the people who come to Cape Town are still predominantly from Europe, from the US, and they would be European white or American whites. And the companies are owned by white South Africans. So we saw with my partner, Malik Robert Katana, to say, well, maybe we have something. He's Kenyan. I'm Zambian from living here now for our 18th year. We met 10 years ago. You know, how can we meet each other, offer this possibility for our fellow Black Africans on the rest of the continent to meet this city without having to navigate that version of, yeah, it's a version of racism, anti-Black racism that the industry thrives in without realizing it, yeah. So that's also meeting people and enabling change, you know, it's shifting the tourist industry, offering a difference. perspective.
Yeah. And you know, it's so interesting you say that because I absolutely saw the difference, right? Because we did a tour with you and then we did a walking tour in downtown Cape Town, which was a historical, like historical sites. And it was led by a white South African who was very patriotic and had great information. But what we kept asking, what about the Black people? You know, all of this. And so a lot of the things that we did, we went to a vineyard and it was like, well, what about the Black people? Right. And so it was always, it never centered that experience. It was always about the white capital. So I absolutely understand that and see that there's a market, there's a market interest for that. So wonderful. So you said something about feminism. I've never heard feminism described in that way.
Oh, really?
Never.
Okay.
And so, yeah. And so I if you can tell me a little, like, just talk a little bit more because, you know, we're in this International Women's Month and the conversations are in that space. How did you come to feminism?
Wow. Okay. That's easy and hard at the same time. So it's easy from the perspective that for me, I cannot remember a time that I didn't encounter feminism because I grew up in a household in which my parents were already very clearly articulating their own feminist politics through their lives. And that my parents are Sarah Longwe and Roy Clark. So Sarah Longwe is Zambian, well-known feminist force standing up against various kinds of discrimination against women in Zambia, continentally and globally. For example, standing up against the school she was teaching at because she was told she couldn't wear trousers because she's a woman. And she was a secondary school teacher in Lusaka, and she stood up against that and changed, got the policy changed around that. She stood up against maternity leave not being granted to women and also benefits if you are not married as a woman at that time. I think then that must have been the 70s, late, probably mid-70s in Zambia. At the time, we had inherited British colonial laws. Around employment and labor, which had inherent in them a patriarchal understanding that if a woman is married, she need not earn an income. And if she's working, she need not have housing benefits and other benefits. She would rely on her husband. And so she came up against these as a young woman entering the teaching profession, whether it's dress, whether it's questions of maternity leave, whether it's benefits. She stood up against those. And then later in life, I remember as a young girl, I think I was 10, 11, 12, where she took a large international hotel, the Intercontinental Hotel, to court for not letting her into the hotel because she was not accompanied by a man. Again, a leftover of the British colonial bylaws, I think it is. And so she took that matter to court, and this case set precedence because the judge used an international instrument, Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination, to make the ruling and therefore invoked the possibility of an international convention being nationalized by one judgment. And that set precedence locally, globally, right? Yeah. So I watched this growing up as a child. The earlier battles before I was born, I didn't watch them, but I grew up learning about them because she spoke, she gave conferences, and she later developed her own framework, women's empowerment framework, known as the Longwe Women's Empowerment Framework, which is still being used today. And actually, she and my father and myself reworked on it, and it's published separately as a book. We're going to launch that actually in a couple of weeks in Lusaka.
Nice.
Just as a standalone. It's actually been integrated into gender training manuals of Oxfam, the UN over the years, but we wanted it available separately. So there's just, I mean, I grew up with these kinds of conversations. I can't remember when I didn't have an understanding of feminist principles, you know, the idea of gender equality and that there are inequalities that are peculiarly around how we are gendered in the world or how we are perceived to be gendered, or how we perform our gendering, you know. And so that's always been, you know, it's always been available to me as a way of thinking, but also as a way of being, looking out for it and saying, hang on a minute, why is this, why am I not being given this opportunity just because of my gender. So in that sense, I can't remember when I haven't been feminist. In that sense, it's easy to answer. But in the other sense, I also know that feminism has evolved differently in different parts of the world.
Exactly.
And often when we're located here on the African continent, people say, but how can you be feminist? You're African. Mm-hmm. Assuming that feminism is a northern construct.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's a northern issue. It's what women in the North, European, white, and, you know.
Yeah.
So there's been that complexity that we on the African continent, I've spent years teaching at the African Gender Institute, now our Department mm-hmm. of African Feminist Studies, to say, look, we have long histories of battles mm-hmm. around questions of justice that are framed around how we are gendered and why it is. And, you know, so I've been teaching about the complexity of understanding that across Africa, we have had this thinking. Just because it's framed feminism now, which is an English version of a principle and ideology, does not alienate me from understanding it. You know,
right.
So teaching about our long histories on the African continent, like the Nigerian Women's War in 1929.
Exactly.
What we now call Eastern Nigeria, revolts against the British taxing and counting system mm-hmm. and trading system that was being posed on markets run by women. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's 1929. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's clearly a version of feminism, right?
Yes.
So it's still a lot of work to be done to be able to, like you say, easily explain what then feminism is,
right?
In our context, in our reality. So that's why it can feel like a difficult question,
right?
Right. So when I move into my own understanding how it evolved, well, that's complex, right?
Sure.
That's quite complex. I didn't think I would be teaching feminism for 16, 17 odd years.
Yeah.
Now that I have, I can say, well, I can't remember when it is I decided to be that person, except that I've never not known of these ideas. Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, I mean, I was just going to ask that question. So you grew up in this activist environment.
Yeah.
And it's difficult. I mean, in many cases, I would imagine it's difficult not to be an activist in an activist environment because you're so aware of it. But when, so how did you kind of chart your path in terms of coming to being an educator and embracing you as in your role?
Yeah, I think one turning point I can remember is when I was a student at the University of Zambia. Mm-hmm. And in our fourth year, I was studying development studies and philosophy. And there was one course that I enrolled for that enabled or that asked of each of us to develop our own research project. So we're learning research skills. And by that time, I had already had my first daughter. I had her when I was in second year. I'd taken a year off and then came back to university. So I was very intrigued as to find out what happened to the other female students who had birthed humans during the course of their studies, because I wasn't the only one, right? Mm-hmm. So I was I knew a few people. Where are these people? How have they coped? What were the options for them? I found that I could not take maternity leave. It didn't exist in the policies of the university. Mm. I had to take 2 weeks sick. And I said, I can't take 2 weeks sick leave. I'm actually having a whole baby. So I took a year off,
okay,
which very few people did.
Yeah,
because I said, I can't be expected to come 2 weeks after giving birth. Mm-hmm. I mean, I need much longer. If you're working, it's at least 3 months. And even that's not enough, we know.
Right, yeah.
And so I did a study and I interviewed women who had a baby and also where I could trace men who had a baby and where I could interview the couples. Mm-hmm. And I think that was a shifting point for me because I got to understand the contrast between mothering and studenthood and how the university system is nowhere near, even up to today, imagining.
Yeah.
You know, able to imagine and how to create policies and environments to enable people to have babies and to enable both parents of the child to continue studies and parent. Most of us, I didn't come across anyone who took a year off like me, but most of the other students either dropped out,
right,
or and I couldn't trace them, obviously, and they came back much later, and that's how I met them, or they had other family members, their mothers. I remember one student whose mother gave birth at the same time as her. And so she took on the baby completely and breastfed the baby.
Wow.
Otherwise, they were just living on the margins of the university system. There was no lodging for them. There was no care giving facilities available, no creches, no space for family to come in onto campus with the baby. If they had that option, they would leave the babies elsewhere or live off campus and come on. And of course, that brought much precarity to their studies. And the people who suffered the most were the people who had to nurse their babies, breastfeed, caretake, or, you know, pregnancy itself. And those are the women. So I think perhaps that was where it became clearer for me, the visceral experience of the effects of an institutional system that doesn't see womanhood, pregnancy, parenting, fatherhood, parenting as integral to education processes to be able to, you know. Yeah. And I mean, humans on average have their children between 20 and 35.
Exactly.
And that's when we are studying at university. So why are these institutions unable to imagine that? Sure. Well, that's because they're framed and built with the imagination that somebody else will do this reproductive labor, not the students. So they imagine it's a narrow framing of masculinity that doesn't do fathering.
Yeah.
In, you know, yeah. In the way we understand it could be. Yeah. So that was it. And then I moved more quickly while studying into being active in Zambian women's rights organizations, all of which had been co-founded by my mother. So that was strange. She founded all the major women's rights NGOs in Zambia. And then I moved on to being a chair of one of the earlier NGOs. I chaired the Zambia Association for Research and Development that focused on feminist research for action, for change. Yeah.
Okay.
And that was at 27.
Okay. So
then I became chair.
And then you were on your way. And so you, some years later, moved on to further academic studies and work, work into Southern Africa.
Yeah. Much later. Yeah, I combined my interest in, so I guess it's an embeddedness in active social justice activism. So I'm committed to this idea of social change. How does social change happen?
Yeah.
And particularly in crisis and flux and precarity. And so I got drawn to conflict resolution, peace building, conflict prevention as a skill set that can accompany the kind of feminist social change processes that I had learned.
Sure. And I think that answers my why the where question, because it sounds like that is the why of where you are and landing in Southern Africa.
Mm. Yeah, I guess so. Because I got then attached to I worked with youth social change programs, civic education programs while I was busy with the women's rights, volunteer work, NGO volunteer work. I got employed as a program manager in a youth project on civic education. And then I got involved in, you know, so I was young at the time. So I'm going to all these youth things, you know, youthhood. No longer in that explicit youthful way. So, and then it was like, well, through some youth, it was a conference on youth and conflict prevention that I went to present what I was doing with this youth program I was working in. And I used my mom's A Long Way Women's Empowerment Framework to talk about how youth empowerment could happen. And so I was already making links between feminism and social change within being young on the African continent, and particularly in Zambia. So that led me into, then I was like, what is this conflict resolution stuff? This is interesting. This is important. You know? And that led me to working for a loose network of NGOs, civil society again, that work on wide range of whatever you might imagine conflict prevention might involve: psychology, counseling, negotiators, mediators, community mobilizers. It was fascinating, really fascinating.
Sure.
So I traveled across 13 Southern African countries holding dialogues about how it is these people enable the possibility of the prevention of violence. Yeah.
Which leads me to ask you about your PhD, because I'm so intrigued by, first of all, how you decided on Uganda. And so tell us about that process and how deep dialogue is so embedded in everything, but really kind of that crystallizing your conflict resolution work, social, looking at social justice and empowering women.
Yeah, so that journey, I think, is still ongoing for me. So back to this embeddedness in social justice activism, I sat on a number of boards after I finished my master's. One of them was an NGO based in Uganda called, at the time, Isis, the Egyptian goddess Isis. And so it was Isis Wike. Isis Wike stood for Women International Cross-Cultural Exchange Program. And what they would do is facilitate exchange amongst women in conflict zones or post-conflict contexts. And so I was on the board of their NGO, and I got to learn so many inspiring and very hard stories about what a lot of African women have been going through in militarized public war zones. So I got to visit some groups in North Uganda, and Uganda there had been going through civil war since 1996 or earlier. Once, soon after Yoweri Museveni came into power, there was internal conflicts articulated in terms of ethnicity, the ethnicities in the North wanting political power, Museveni coming from another area, own history taking over, and the tension went into North Uganda. So I was inspired by listening to stories all over the continent, right? Because this organization worked continentally. However, for my PhD, I had to really narrow down to a context that I could work over a long period of time with and go really deep. And so I picked North Uganda because the organization was based there, and they had seeded, they had co-founded numerous community-based organizations during the height of the war in North Uganda. And so there was that kind of solidarity work that I was already embedded in by virtue of being on the board. And so I thought, let me continue that through my PhD and honor the knowledges that these women had fathomed in very hard context. And my idea is and was to theorize from the ground. What do these women think the link is between femininity, feminism, and building peace in these kind of militarized, difficult contexts, right? So that's what led me there. And so I did the PhD over 8 years while I was teaching at the African Gender Institute. I had many things going on, also being a single mother here in Cape Town. I moved with my two children just after separating from their father. So there's a lot going on for me. Yeah, that's what took me there. And I think I'm still there in my heart and my mind as we think now of where the world is at with militarism, war economies, crisis and precarity. I still come back to what I learned and what I continue to learn from people who live in the midst of crisis. If we had to talk to people in South Sudan, in Eastern DRC, in Palestine, if we talk to those women, immense wisdom that has been gained from survival and precarity. And I think that's the deepest kind of wisdom one can gain. You don't learn how to deal with crisis in a textbook. You learn how to deal with crisis by being in crisis.
Right. You know? Absolutely. And then, so the peace building process, because a bit of it, your study, it spanned that, those many years, but then you've seen the aftermath. And so when you think about peace building, particularly now thinking about, you know, we're in this world where the only answer now is peace building. What are some of what are some of your key takeaways? And if you were to project and spray paint the ideas, you know, across borders and really change minds, what would you say or do?
What I learned from, let me go back to North Uganda and my PhD process. One of the huge wisdoms that I gained from that process, you know, when they're asking women who founded these CBOs, why did you found this CBO at the height of the war to focus on women only?
Right.
Because everybody was going through crisis. Why women only? Yeah. And this was before there was rhetoric, this UN Security Council resolution on women, peace, and security. It was before that time. Mm-hmm. And the answer I got was not what I expected. They said, well, we had no choice because the men were not there. So I said, what do you mean they were not there? I mean, everyone. Mm-hmm. They stayed home to defend the land. They stayed to fight, and then the women ran, you know, came to the city centers where these women who founded the NGOs were based. So they were not located where, you know, they had families there, but they were receiving, right? And who are they receiving first? So then you look at how gendered social systems operate, right? So if men are perceived as protectors of land and cattle and masculinities are tied to that, they must fight. And then the women then gather resources to survive, hoping that that would shift. And it doesn't shift. Years are passing, 26 right. years are passing. And they said the men were missing and the men became useless. So masculinities became so fractured that they were now not even, forget about protecting, feeding, all the other things, you know. So they said we had to gather ourselves. And these were bunches of friends. These were just gathering food, salt, clothes, and then they formalized that. So the first thing is to really pay attention to what are the social systems that yeah. work and what's fractured.
Right.
Because that will tell you where it is your emphasis needs to go.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Mm-hmm. And they were women themselves. They could connect with those femininities. They had residence. They had solidarity. Right. And then the other piece was then, okay, understanding that, they then moved into what up to today UN systems, government systems haven't actually institutionalized. So we first thing, delivery of food, ceasefire.
Yes.
There's huge trauma in this space.
Yes.
There's huge trauma.
Yes.
And it keeps being recreated, like re-triggered. Psychosocial, also material trauma, mm-hmm. right? So mm-hmm. you can give me food, but if I never get to the place of coming back to my own independence or feeding myself, that's a trauma in and of itself.
Exactly.
Continuous dependency.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what they did was a form of demilitarization and recovery of societies by enabling group storytelling processes that built self-confidence and enabled release of the pain that they had witnessed and took part in.
Mm.
Because in this war, both women and men were recruited forcibly by fighting forces.
Mm.
And mm-hmm. girls were adopted and they came back mothers of mm-hmm. of children
mm-hmm.
That were born via forced marriage, which essentially is a version of rape.
Yes.
And so they would gather these women. And so the reconstruction programs of the government and the international humanitarian system did not imagine what they would do with women and girls who came back from fighting.
Right.
These women did. They anticipated that. And so they brought them into community with other women to tell stories and then to rebuild their material livelihoods and reconnect with their families and through ritual and cleansing. So they also dealt with spiritual
mm-hmm.
healing mm-hmm. and reintegration mm-hmm. through, they knew their own cleansing systems. If you've done something bad in society, this is the ceremony that will enable for your family to receive you. And so they facilitated that and they sought money. They formed NGOs so they could get money to enable these ceremonies and rituals. And those who were not integrated kept them in groups in which they told stories while making money, while plowing the fields, and that enabled mm-hmm. a release and a healing
mm-hmm.
process.
Wow.
That is not individualistic, it's collective. It's not saying you have a trauma in your head, let's diagnose you. No, it's about we all are in a society that has gone through, that is remembering too much. We need to release those memories through solidarity and storytelling and paraphrasing and rituals and singing and dancing.
Sure.
And so that was powerful. And then they could then know these women. Where are you from? Through that deep storytelling. Where are you from? What are you struggling? And then they'll connect those people back to their families, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and if not, create another family through that process. And then they got to understand, who are these generals who are still fighting? Oh, that one. I know his mother. He doesn't know his mother is alive. Go into the bush because they're elderly women respected. They're not shot. They're not seen as a threat. And they'll say, excuse me, my son, your mother is still alive. She's waiting for you. We will allow you to see her. So they enabled demobilization for soldiers to come back home at the time when Amnesty International was really struggling to do that. They went on radios. Those stories they heard gave them the nuanced knowledges of the people who were fighting, and they connected with their hearts.
Wow.
And their families.
Wow. Wow.
And so what's that? That is thinking about humanitarian work as also the possibility of deep psychosocial healing and spiritual healing,
yes.
which our current humanitarian processes don't imagine. And how do you, and of course, drawing on femininity as sources of that wisdom. And because femininity is in this war, we're not seen as sources of gun violence.
Mm-hmm.
There is a lot that the army could not do, or the UN peacekeepers who were hardly present in this war, in this reconstruction process. But often, you know, military uniform, which is a presentation of masculinity, which is often, you know, seen as a threat by fighting forces.
Yeah.
They often can't get that kind of knowledge. So really grounded understanding of femininities and it's not our knowledges, and even if it's normative femininities, you know,
yeah,
this context, heterosexual, probably Christian, probably Islam, probably, you know,
mm-hmm.
Ethnicized, but that grounded understanding of femininities as offering perspective
mm-hmm.
that,
mm-hmm.
yeah, that, what is not found in mainstream peace processes that are informed, not explicitly, but implicitly, by a normative masculine interpretation of reconstruction after war.
Right.
So, yeah, I think that really helped me understand what we are missing sometimes, you know. So when we think of Palestine now, we think of Sudan, and you think of DS, all these different places, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you have the opportunity to connect with people on the ground, who to connect with and how to, what might be the places for grounded wisdom about how peace might unfold differently
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
or not.
I feel like that's ultimately what we're talking about is a new decolonized mindset around peace building, because, you know, never focused on peace building. You know, that's never been part of what colonization was about. It's about an economic construct and peace building. So decolonizing the ideas of peace building is ultimately a way forward. And it sounds like it's grounded in women's efforts. So as a model.
Yeah. I mean, you can find it there. And you can also find it in non-normative masculinities, the non-fighting masculinities, the non-war-honed masculinities.
Sure.
And femininities also get war-honed, right? In this case, recruited into the militia groups. And these women who were not recruited into the militia groups worked with those who came back from being recruited and recrafted based on normative femininities. Rebuilding, and reconnecting and healing deep heart connections to enable the imagination of something other than the continuation of war. So, yeah, it takes structures, it takes money, it takes systems, right?
Yeah.
So this is happening disconnected from the Amnesty International processes. And one of the women's groups got attached to Amnesty International, Kiwepi. Kit Kum's Women's Peace Initiatives. And another one, who I know, Kichwa. It was a women's group. It was Kit. So Kit Kum is this small town. And Kichwa was focusing on children. So they actually recreated a home environment for all these children that were coming back. Their parents could not be found, or their parent, you know, and they actually recreated a home village environment to reintegrate the children. Amnesty had no plan. So they would send the children they received from the fighting groups to this center. It became a center, and it was founded by these women's groups out of their hearts of, nobody's claiming these children. We will claim them and we will look after them together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So if there was enough funds and enough commitment to thinking differently about post-war reintegration and healing and peace processes could go, you know, a lot more money could go to that kind of approach.
Exactly. And it's not expensive. That's where it always breaks down. These things are not expensive. They just need attention to legitimizing.
Yeah, they did that. Very little money.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. It sounds like so interesting. So thinking about your works and across borders and in many countries, I'd like to ask a question about glocal speak. So it's a word, a phrase, or a saying that's an interesting part of your local experience and how you've come to value it as a glocal speak.
So a word that from here, from where I'm living.
So wherever you felt local. So I give you the flexibility to choose from wherever you felt local. So, sure.
Local is, mm-hmm. local is many places. Mm-hmm. Can I pass on that? No, I can't think of a word. I had a word and I've just forgotten it.
That's no problem.
But it will come without thinking too hard.
No problem. So I want to talk a little bit more about now thinking about your tour company.
Yeah.
You've come as a migrant worker to another country.
Yeah.
And so thinking about how you want to show and share stories, because I feel like there's definitely a storyteller in you at the core of everything that you are. And so how did you come to Malia?
Yes. So came to Malia, as you well know, Cape Town is a really beautiful city. And even if there were no buildings, it's beautiful. It's not the building.
It's the place.
It's the nature. Yeah. It's the mountain. It's the rocks, the connection between the earth and the sea, the different ways in which that those two meet. And then it's the landscape when you leave the sea. It's the way the mountains and the hills roll out. And the landscape changes quite quickly as you go over one mountain. And so it's the beauty of the place that everyone who comes here falls in love with. So I fell in love with that. And so did when I met my partner in 2013, we understood that we love taking drives into nature and going to places that are non-typical tourist sites, right? And discovering other parts of this Western Cape that feed the soul, that are just amazing to be in, to look at, to breathe in, to witness.
Yes.
And so we thought, what is it about being from other countries in the rest of Africa, something about not being South African and our interpretation of this landscape and how it interfaces with the history of this place and our positionality as people. In my body, I come across here in South Africa as what South Africans would call colored. There's a local word for you. which is a mixture of what and what. And it has very harsh history to it if you were framed colored during the apartheid.
Yes.
Period, right? In between black and white. So got some privileges of whiteness and not others. And then my partner is Kenyan and he looks here. He's clearly what South Africans or Cape Townians would say African.
Yeah.
African meaning black. Mm-hmm. So strange. That's sort of like, we'll play around with what happens when we enter a wine farm, me and him. A farm that is there because of this history of land dispossession and the current capitalist economy, which is that of white capital still owned by people who are historically came here dispossessed. We feel the tension in that wine farm, mm-hmm. as we, you know, mm-hmm. we notice, as you did, mm-hmm. We're the only people who are not white. Okay, what is that? What's this doing to the staff here? What does it mean for us to right. ask about a history that is not being spoken here?
Yes.
Because of my studies and my location, I can access that history from the library of the University of Cape Town, through seminars, through literature. And so I know this history. So I'm sitting there and I know what they're not telling me. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, ooh, this is quite uncomfortable.
Yeah.
What would it be like to share with people the fuller story before they get to the farm? Wouldn't that give some perspective? And what about hearing that story from the perspective of people who are not South African, however raced, colored, and Black African? You know, and I thought that was an interesting entanglement to share, not as a way of regurgitating pain, but as a way of honoring the past and offering a perspective to life here in Cape Town that is not, does not leave people in this bubble of white capital and class privilege.
Yeah.
So that's how we came to it. So it was long conversations. We visit this mm-hmm. farm, we visit this, you know, mountain, and the name of the mountain is Rochelle. Who is Rochelle?
Right.
This is in Franschhoek. What's the history of Franschhoek? What did the indigenous people call this mountain?
Exactly.
We now know, you know, Table Mountain mm-hmm. is Kwako. I never can pronounce it well enough, but, you know, that now finding those indigenous names, understanding those histories, as a tourist experience, you know, mm-hmm. and then enabling us to connect with our deep shared history as Africans.
Yeah.
And it is a history of unfortunately colonial pain. Mm-hmm. And now we can share it as a way of, so what else is possible here? You know, so we also take people to Black owned wine farms, mm-hmm. the few that do exist, and also do some research on that farm, connect with the owners, and so that they know that we're bringing people who are particularly interested in their personal story. Like you're asking me, where are you from?
Yes.
You know, what happened?
Yes.
Uh-huh. You know, that they can tell that story as well as the story of the wine.
Right.
You know, how did you found
yeah.
it? You know,
yeah.
Who are your ancestors? And this one amazing one in Franschhoek that's founded by the son. His whole family worked on a wine farm for generations, and his mom worked on that farm all her life. She was the chief taster of this famous wine. I've forgotten the name now. So, but he founded his own wine farm and employed people from that farm and named his first signature wine after his mom.
Wow.
So that story, you know, so he's colored Black,
yeah,
Cape Tonian, grew up in that area, Franschhoek. And so that transformation is just as much as a big story as how the wine tastes and its flavors and how it's grown and that, you know,
yeah.
that jewel. So that's been our mission, to enable that possibility and host the tours not as a, you know, a distant experience mm-hmm. where you have this to a guide who is quite separate from you, just doing their mm-hmm, job. You know, mm-hmm, we live here, we will host you like you're our friends.
Yeah.
And we will chill with you and share our story on the drive to the places.
Yeah.
Create the tours that meet your expectations. We created a wellness tour during the height of COVID. We had a tour for Creative Minds. We have all these different, and we craft them around who it is we're receiving.
Sure.
In yeah. that way, also honoring their positionalities, their stories, mm-hmm. framed the story that we can then curate on the tour.
Yeah, yeah, I love that. I mean, I love that perspective, and I think that is so needed. And I think that you may be having a run for your money soon with all of the, you know, new rediscovery yeah. of Let's Travel to Africa. So your research yeah. and your writings might might suffer.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing, right?
Yeah.
The balance. I find that I do many things and I'm connected with many stories and people across the world, you know.
Yeah.
So when you ask me about Uganda, I have names and places and people and stories and
yeah.
words, you know. here and then Zambia and then the places I've traveled and done my work.
Yeah.
So I'm local in many places. I think that's why I'm struggling to find a word. Just one came to me now.
Okay.
It's not a word. It's actually a, what do you call those things? An expression.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
That I really love when I moved to Cape Town. So, you know, when you're surprised or, you know, you want to really express some like, wow, what did you just say? What do you, you know?
Yeah.
There's a sound, an expressive sound that I really love when I moved here. And it goes as follows. It goes, ooh-eh, hi, ooh-eh, you know, and that's like Xhosa women, right?
Okay.
And it's just, it's so expressive. It's full of meaning, you know, that, what are you saying? Oh, that's amazing. Oh, you gotta be kidding me. Oh, you know. Ooh, hi, Boena.
I love it.
So I like these kinds of words or expressive tonage. In Zambia, we have many like that.
Yes.
And my friends laugh at me when I'm talking because I do a lot of you know. Yeah. And it's Cape Townians who alert this to me, you know, to say, but, you know, why? You have so many in-between sounds.
But it's participating. Yeah. It's like, how do
yes,
we...
it's participating in the conversation.
Right.
So.
Yeah.
So that one just came to me. I love that about different languages.
Yes.
Not so much the words themselves, but it's the...
the delivery.
Tonage.
Mm-hmm, the tonage.
And the... expressive sounds in between the words that make sometimes more meaning.
Yeah. Right. Of course. So speaking of that, let's talk about mindset. So do you have a mindset hack? One that you practice, one that you know of, one that you can imagine? How do you mindset hack yourself?
So there's a practice I met when I was 14.
Mm.
It's a meditative practice. Mm-hmm. Based on a version of Buddhism that traveled through Japan. And there was a Buddhist monk in the 13th century known as Nichiren Daishonin who used the title, one of the titles of one of the chapters of the Lotus Sutra, which is a key text in all Buddhist communities. But people read different sections and, you know, travel very complex.
Yeah.
But anyways, there's a phrase called Nam-myoho-renge-kyo. Nam-myoho-renge-kyo. So I learned at 14 through my sister, who you met, who ended up creating this connection we have. She met that practice, reciting of that phrase, when she was 16. And I'm 2 years younger than her. I was 14. And so I watched her recite this phrase as a meditative practice and saw her come out of a deep depression she was in at the time. It was so bad that her body was also getting ill. And so in support of her recovery, I joined her in this practice. We shared a room. And yeah, so since I was 14, whenever I was in a deep problem, I would say, oh my gosh, let me just go and meditate. Let me just go and we call it chant.
Yes.
And I did that for 14 years, just ad hoc, only when I was stuck.
Yeah.
And then at 28, I thought, wow, I just better get this together. It always works when I do it. So let me just do it consistently. Mm-hmm. So then I then began to practice it daily and got the scroll and I have a place where I meditate.
Yeah.
And so that's really what keeps me focused, centered. And when I'm not centered, or when I'm feeling reluctant, like I told you I am today.
Hopefully you're less.
I managed to do this despite that.
Yes.
And I will go and after this sit and, you know, clear my mind. It's, you know, as most meditative practice are, there it's about breath and focus and attuning the body to clear the mind.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, as humans, our minds then keep us quite stabilized sometimes.
Yeah.
And so that's my mind hack, definitely.
Yeah.
I do it in community. Mm-hmm. And so I understand, I guess that comes back to social justice activism. You can't change anything alone.
Yes.
In that kind of change, thinking of change processes. So I do it in community with a Nichiren Daishonin inversion of Buddhism here in Cape Town. It's also there in Zambia. Wherever I go in the world, if I stay long enough, I will find somebody who practices this through our networks. And that's been very powerful for me, alongside a number of Buddhist principles that really sort of clear my focus and intention and help me sort of discern. So what does this mean? Why am I in this fix? Or holding this fix? Why is my heart heavy? Mm-hmm. You know, ideas around karma, connection between yourself and the environment. There's another concept I really love called Ichin and Sanzen, which stands for 3,000 possibilities contained in one life moment. And this meditative practice helps to heighten one's life state to be able to see more than, usually when you're feeling stuck or whatever, you feel like there's only two things I can do. You know,
exactly.
But to open up the range of possibilities is to heighten one's life state.
Yes.
To see those possibilities or to discern or whatever.
Yeah.
So Buddhist principles also help me in the mind hacks. So it's not sort of blindly meditating, but also with an ontological worldview that says, okay, I understand why it is the world is the way it is and where I lie in it. So that plus meditation is powerful for me.
That's wonderful. I can definitely appreciate that. And so the show notes, folks, this week's show notes are going to be wonderful because you've given us so many gems to go back to and refer to. I could talk to you for hours and hours because I absolutely love this conversation, but I know we both have our days to get along with. And so before we sign off, I want to ask who Yaliwe is when she's not giving tours, when she's not being a conflict resolution practitioner, when she's not doing the deep, deep dialogues. Are you a reader? Are you a watcher? Are you a listener? And what are some of your favorite reads, watches, or listens? Or what are some of your other pastimes?
I'm a reader for action. Okay. I don't generally just read a novel because it's amazing story and imagination. I wish I could be that reader. I read when I'm facing situations. So the current book that's really helping me is by Adrienne Marie Brown, who's an African-American, actually. And she wrote this book called Emergent Strategy. And that's really helping me think about the work, the peace-building work that I do in feminist organizations, but also just generally thinking about how we can connect with who we are deeply in an emergent way, in an organic way. And so she's writing about her own story in social justice activism and then nuggets of wisdom that she's discerned along the way. So I like that she writes it a little bit like a story, you know, a context, a history, and then some philosophy about how action happens. So that's where I'm stuck now. So when I have my next dialogue, I go into, okay, I'm facilitating this, you know, what, how can I think about what kind of dialogue process this would be? Let me go to Marie, you know, Adrienne Marie Brown and see what I can find. So that's one thing I do, but it's really reading for like change. Like, how do I change the world? That's how I read. When I was teaching, I read to see how do I change minds? Okay, let me bring this idea, that idea. And so I read widely for that. You know, you can see all those books there, or reading to write my PhD or my master's or whatever. And then so now my pastime is actually also listening now, because there's a lot to listen to.
So much.
And then I created my own stuff to listen to. I interviewed my mom. I'm writing about her life. And so I've got these interviews to listen to. So just listening to me interviewing her is a pastime I'm creating now that I'm not teaching and not full-time employed with a university. And the other time is a lot now, is a lot of rest and silence.
I heard that.
So I think, as you heard, you know, I did my PhD while I was teaching single motherhood. I migrated. It's like 17 years of doing many things. And I was also a warden in a residence dealing with student crisis.
Oh, wow, yeah.
You know, every week through, before and through COVID. And so now is a time. So this is where Malia Tours and Transport Fairs, even when we don't have clients, we go on a drive as we did before we founded it, just to see and connect with nature and rest and being silent and therefore travel.
Yes.
So before I'll travel for work, I'll travel to see family. Now when I get a consultancy, as I have been getting in the last year since I left the university, I got flown to Bali in Indonesia to help a feminist organization with their strategic planning process. I stayed extra in Bali, and then I asked them to fly me to Zanzibar, and I had no return date. I stayed until I felt I was ready. And what did I do? A lot of just quiet, interacting with people, not with in a workshop, in a dialogue, in a classroom, just being, hello, eye contact, sitting, connecting with the sea, swimming with the turtles, going with the dolphins. Money or no money, I just thought, whatever I have now, it's enough.
Yes.
I got here, flown from my last consultancy, that's enough.
Yeah,
you know, and luckily my children have grown. So a lot of that kind of, you know, like today with my reluctant feeling, not much has happened until now. One meeting before you, and then it's sitting, maybe listening to something, watching a movie now that we have Netflix and Showmax, but watching things that help me rest.
I love that. Nice. Well, thank you so much for your reluctant time today. I didn't feel at all that you were at all reluctant. I love the flow. I loved your energy, and you are appreciated.
Thank you
for the work that you've been doing. Do you have any last thoughts you'd like to share with our audience today?
Only that life is an adventure, I guess. Mm-hmm. Even crisis is an adventure, and our hearts are a powerful source of direction, I've been thinking a lot about love and the heart, not romantic love between individuals. I've been thinking about love for humanity.
Exactly. Yeah. Same here.
Love for humanity. And I've been working on a podcast with an amazing woman called Pregs Govender. And that's the podcast I wanted to say.
Oh, yeah.
Love and Insubordination by Pregs Govender. And we did a podcast together called Free Palestine and Humanity.
Perfect. Thank you for
and
that.
And there we talk about love. So just that thing, life is an adventure.
Yes.
Even crisis is an adventure. And our hearts, our collective hearts, I think, our collective love for humanity is really where we can be guided.
Thank you. Thank you for that guidance. All right, listeners, this has been another episode of the podcast. You can catch us Tuesdays with new episodes at globalcitizenspod.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Please like, share, subscribe, leave us a review. We're looking for 100 in 2024. I haven't checked lately, but I am going to check, and I'm going to reprimand you folks if you haven't made your reviews. So just keeping it light. So until next time, bye for now.